It's the product of 12 years of very intensive research. The book is built upon a doctorate that Leslie wrote at Cambridge. It's a book which gathers together an enormous amount of research, but it's very readable. That's something people really need to know. It's not some academic tome. It's fast-moving. It was very much a labor of love. We traveled out to Tibet in the late 90s, and we were actually guests of the Chinese government, which was an interesting thing. They were trying to show us around China and get us to think positively of China. But when we got to Tibet, which was at our request, we encountered a situation which was absolutely horrific. The Tibetan monks, the monasteries, were under tight surveillance. We found that we couldn't have conversations with monks, even on the stairways, which weren't being recorded, both audio and video. We sensed a real fear amongst the population in downtown Lhasa, and we slowly began to realize that the Chinese had systematically proceeded to deconstruct Tibetan society. We were deeply affected by that. You have to acknowledge that the Chinese have put a great deal of money into Tibet. The assumption has been, well, if we improve the material well-being of these people, they will sort of move away from their culture and accept China as the motherland. And that's what has not happened.
And a large problem for Tibetans and the other groups is they have very little or no leverage to affect their position or change what has happened with the Chinese coming in, and very little support from the outside as well.
You know, it's interesting you mention that. In fact, I think that's an absolutely excellent point, a key point. There is no leverage, as you say, available to the local Tibetans to resist this Chinese influx. But there is an odd type of leverage available within the global community. Tibet exercises a unique soft power. It is the power of moral condemnation. And people around the world look at what the Chinese are doing in Tibet, and they ask very probing questions. What kind of culture could be doing this to these Tibetan Buddhists? That power of broad condemnation and criticism, that's really driving the Chinese nuts, because they don't have a way of containing it. And it leads me to think that this six-decade-long occupation of Tibet by China has really benefited neither China nor Tibet.
The United States views all the regions of China basically as a part of China and has done so for quite a long time. The longer this goes on, does that make it more difficult for Washington to tell Beijing perhaps you should be changing course and doing something else?
Well, the longer it goes on, the more it's taken for granted. And we do indeed recognize these various areas of China as parts of China, including Taiwan. But it seems to me we are more broadly ready for a re-evaluation of our China policy. This is a policy which arose from the Nixon-Kissinger opening in 1971 and 72. It was a narrative that Kissinger brought back which said, this relationship will benefit American trade, it'll enhance American quality of life, it will bring jobs, it will bring stability to East Asia and global stability as well. And when we look at it today, we see that actually none of those things have happened. You know, China is such a strange place. It has no friends. If you look at East Asia, and all the way from Japan through the Philippines to Vietnam to all the way down to India, none of those countries are friendly towards China. China has some commercial relationships, but for the most part, these relations are informed by fear. So China's got some difficulties there. It has difficulties within its party. It has different factions within the military, and its corruption campaign is upending age-old relationships between the great state-owned enterprises and many of the investors and banks. So this is a country which is challenged by domestic governance, and it doesn't need additional pressure on the outside. That's why it could be that this is a time when we can exert some pressure and perhaps get some change.
Certainly brings up where Tibet goes from here and how the West approaches it.
You know, I think that's really the issue. In the West, and we talk about this a good deal in the book, we've come to be fascinated with the myth of Tibet. It started with Herodotus in the 5th century, who claimed to see gold-digging ants. It went on to the 1400s, where Odoric, who was a Dominican missionary, came back with tales of fantastic beasts, women with teeth as long as boar's tusks, led to the sense that Tibet was a truly mystical, sometimes frightening place. And that myth was picked up, and the British, when they were there in the 18th, early 19th century, and the whole myth continued with Roosevelt, who named Camp David Shangri-La, and on into the present time. America presents itself in global terms as having certain beliefs and values and wanting to be a beacon of rationality on issues. Unfortunately, we have not managed to see those values or those principles reflected in the Tibetan experience. There are a lot of reasons for it. The fact is, Tibet really is on the other side of the world. It is not bounded by water. We have no obvious way in to be helpful. So where do we go from here? The question we posed a moment ago is whether China will feel sufficient pressure and come to realize that the gain has been very modest from being in Tibet, whether they will agree to some modification of their governance. And I say that knowing full well that China relies upon the rivers that flow from Tibet to provide water to large portions of central China. So they're not going to give the area up. And they're not going to surrender their responsibility for foreign policy and defense, but they might moderate their domestic governance. And if we could encourage that, that would be a wonderful thing.